This is Jane McGonigal, the author of Super Better and a big fan of the Psych Tech Podcast. You're listening to Psych Tech Podcast, where you will get the future of psychology and technology.
Hey, Psych Tech listeners, welcome to another exciting episode of Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast, where we explore the human side of technology. I am Kelly Dunlap, and as always, I'm joined by Josue Cardona.
Hey, Kelly.
I know how it's going. You've had a rough week.
I've had better. How was yours?
Well, I don't want to brag, but it was pretty fantastic.
Why?
Well, I went to GDC. It's the Game Developers Conference. It is the largest game industry conference in the U.S., possibly the world. And it took place in San Francisco, which was always a beautiful place to go. And I spent an entire week there. I had a presentation on Monday where I talked about community engagement at the intersection of games and news. And then I got to spend the rest of the week attending panels, rubbing elbows, kissing babies, you know, networking stuff.
Yeah, GDC is cool because it's not a trade show like E3, and it's not a fan show like PAX and PAX East. It's different because it's the people who are making games coming together and learning from each other, right?
Yes. So it's mostly industry professionals. All of the talks were by professionals in the industry. And, you know, I visited the show floor. There were games there. So, for example, I went to ID at Xbox, which is a collection of Xbox's independent developed games. Although Halo was there, and I totally played. Not quite sure that's an ID game, but hey, you know, I didn't mind. There was also the Samsung VR experience that I went to. There was Google had a really big presence. Oculus had a two-story, enormous booth is just not even the right word for it. It was like its own structure within the expo hall. So it's a very overwhelming experience, but at the same time, with my experience at PAX, it seemed really chill because only about 30,000 people are allowed into GDC, whereas PAX usually has around 80. So I could walk around the show floor and I was not pressed. I could like walk up to a game and play that game, which was a very, very unique experience. But that aside, what I really wanted to dive into were mostly the talks and the kind of experience I had being surrounded by people who are so much more technical than I am, as opposed to psychology-based. And I guess the very first way to kind of start things off was I noticed as I was planning out my schedule that if it had the word psychology or cognitive in it, it was total Kelly bait, and I put all those in my schedule. And what I discovered by the end of the week is that I would probably say about 90% of the panels I attended that were about some aspect of psychology and psychological research were presented by people who were not psychologists and were not researchers.
Okay.
Which was really, I don't want to say it was shocking because I know that psychology and games don't exactly have the healthiest relationship, but it was still very odd to be sitting in a room as someone is talking about self-determination theory and the Big Five and realizing that he is a head program developer at Ubisoft with no training whatsoever in psychology or research methods. It was almost Twilight Zone in that kind of way.
Okay, so it sounds like you have a lot to say, and I'm super jealous because the closest I've ever been to GDC is I visited San Francisco when it was happening. And I saw everybody walking around with their tags, their badges. So I'm super jealous. So I'm going to get comfortable, grab some popcorn, let you do your thing. And then I'll ask questions periodically. But I'm very excited. So go for it.
All right. So I don't even know how to do it. So my favorite talk was actually an education talk, which I thought Josue would have loved to have been there. It yes. was a how to teach games through games. For example, there was a guy from Mole Industria, and if you're not familiar with them, I know I certainly wasn't until I started my program, they make really subversive games, games that have a lot of strong rhetoric and a lot of strong commentary in them. And what he talked about was how he took his game design students and had them play a game with the intention of breaking it to find the limitations, the rule set of that game. you know, if you try to play Grand Theft Auto as a pacifist, you're going to have a really different experience than saying playing Grand Theft Auto in the way that it was intended to be played. The other guy who came up, Nick Fortuna, I think is what his name was, he talked about MDA, the MDA frameworks, the Mechanics, Dynamics, and Aesthetics framework, and that's game speak, and it translates to psychological speak. Obviously, mechanics being what you do in the game, like what you're actually able to do. Dynamics is the decisions that you make, and the aesthetics is the emotion that you experience as a result of those decisions. And so what he had us do was we played a game of 20 questions, and we had unlimited time, and we had 20 questions, and we had to guess what the judge was thinking, which was a little bit unfair considering it's a game conference. We all kind of knew somebody would be thinking of a game, but so we did
that. Remember when we tried to do that on the show?
Yeah, it didn't go so well.
And failed week after week? Yeah.
Yeah. But what was fun, and this might be a change for us then, is that after we did that, you know, he asked about what was the experience about. So, Josue, when you play 20 questions, what is the experience of playing 20 questions like for you?
For me? Like, what is my, like, how would I describe the feelings that I have throughout it?
Yeah, like, if you were to play a game of 20 questions and then describe what it's like to play that game cognitively or emotionally, what would you say?
It's like putting a puzzle together for me. So it can be a lot of fun when pieces start falling together, and it can be very frustrating when nothing falls together, when nothing fits. So it's a roller coaster, but I don't know. It's a fun exercise. I like playing 20 questions,
okay.
But it, like any game, it's no fun if you're not making any progress.
Right. But you would say, you said a puzzler, kind of like a more cerebral, logic-based kind of game.
Yep, absolutely.
So the next game he had us play was also 20 questions, but he changed the game mechanic. So instead of having 20 questions, unlimited time, we had unlimited questions and we had 30 seconds. So unlimited questions, limited time. And then we played a round of that. And it was insane. As you can imagine, people just start yelling anything that comes to their mind. And after playing that version, instead of this logical, sometimes frustrating but puzzly based experience, it was hectic, it was frantic. The emotion of it was like tense and nerve-wracking, and when you got it, my team got it. I think we're the only team that did. You know, when we got it, it was like, yes, it was even more of a Fiero moment because of the extra pressure. And so he used that as an example of when you change the mechanic of the game, so going from limited questions to unlimited questions, and from unlimited time to limited time, you completely change the dynamic, so the way you engage with the game, and the aesthetic, the way you feel about the game when the game's played. And so this, as a way to just kind of show that games are a system, a lot like, say, family systems in therapy. You know, you change one thing, and it's going to have effects in other places as well.
Yeah. That reminds me, a class I used to teach, I changed the rules halfway through the school year, and I said, from now on, tests are, you have unlimited tries on your tests. And so you could take a test, and instead of, like, again, like this slow, calculated, you know, nerve-wracking experience that you only have this limited, it's a very limited opportunity to actually succeed. Mm-hmm. Now you have, like, an unlimited amount of time to, unlimited attempts at the test. And like the effects that I saw there were also like, it was night and day. And some people didn't even, like they didn't even have to repeat the test, just the reframing of it and the difference in the way it was played, I guess, totally changed things. Even just like they were more relaxed because they knew they had more opportunities.
Yeah. So just the idea that you change one thing and it changes the entire system and how people react to it, which I thought was brilliant. And I mean, this panel was full of brilliant people. Mia Consalvo spoke. Me Too, I can't pronounce her last name, but her name's Me Too, and she's at the New York University Game Design School. There, I think I mentioned the other two, but you know, it was really great. And that was the first panel I went to, and that was like the high note of one of the high notes of the panel experience. And then it kind of went downhill. And so you were talking about how, you know, like the jealousy factor. And I know when I went into GDC, I had this thought, okay, this is the APA convention of games. You know, this is the height of smart people in games. And what
say APA convention, that's not necessarily like a good thing, is it?
Well, I mean, it's the biggest convention for psychologists. It's like the most important convention for psychologists. You're right, conceptually. And what I discovered through GDC is that the hype was too much. And I mean, again, there were a couple of just really amazing talks that I feel so grateful that I got to see, but the most of them were just like, I could take it or leave it. It was not this huge mind-blowing experience that I was expecting. And for the first time in my life, I walked out of a panel.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Now, well, you once walked out of a panel at PAX East.
Well, that was for ethical reasons. I didn't feel like I could be there without having to intervene with the people who were doing what they were doing.
But also, that was also psychology and gaming related, and a Ubisoft employee.
Yeah, with non-psychologists. But this one, it was, I don't want to go too specific because I made a lot of friends at GDC and I don't want to alienate anybody, but it was billed as one thing and it really turned out to be more of like a leadership seminar. And they use a lot of psychology terms that they really didn't. I had to leave. I was like, this is one. It was not what, it wasn't accurately reflected in the description. Mm-hmm. And then just the talk itself was, I was like, no. So that was one of the second one I went to. So I had this huge high experience of yes, I've been waiting for this. And then there was one that I walked out of. So that was,
how far into it did you walk out? Just curious.
It was an hour panel and I gave it 20 minutes.
Ooh.
That's usually my cutoff because, okay, introductions, you're getting warmed up, you're getting comfortable. I can appreciate that. But after 20 minutes, if we're not firing on all cylinders of what I'm expecting, especially because GDC has what I found to be a problem is they would schedule 10, 20 talks at the same time.
Yeah.
And some of the talks are only half an hour. A lot of the talks are only half an hour, which as an attendee, I really, really liked. And I'm sure there's some psychology behind this. So I much preferred the half an hour talks to the hour talks as the attendee, mm-hmm. which was interesting because then I felt like I got to do more. I got to see more perspectives. So that was kind of the highs and the lows, but I'm trying to think of what would be the best thing to talk about. Oh my gosh.
Well,
okay.
I we can do this later, but I do want to touch on the overall sense of misrepresentation of psychological concepts and themes in, you know, being presented there. So we don't have to do that right now, but, you know, keep that in mind.
Yeah, definitely want to circle back to that. There was one that, I was like, oh man, I wish Josue was here. It's called Awesome Video Game Data. And
sounds
it
wonderful.
It was delicious, let me tell you. So, I mean, it was like the ESA data, but on steroids.
Mm.
So the Entertainment Software Association usually collects every year who's playing and what are they playing and what's selling and whatnot. And this one was even deeper, like examining console sales and how people think that it's less. But when you look at these different things, you see that it's actually more than where the 360 was in the last generation. A really interesting look at people who buy retail versus people who buy digital and looking at the kind of people that are making that decision. And
what kind of insights were there about that, if you remember any?
I actually had my notes up because I took a lot of notes. So physical copies still reign supreme. So more than 70% of people who play games still buy retail editions, which I thought was enormous because I can't remember the last time I bought a retail edition. But the reason they talked about, or the reason they think that is, one is that gifting is hard. So if I wanted to send Josue a copy of Rise of Tomb Raider, I'd have to physically send you a copy, which is not the most convenient thing in the world, as opposed to being able to send you a code or something like that. Gifting actually is pretty difficult in terms of sharing content. You can't sell the game back, which is a big detractor for a lot of people who play games. And oddly enough, the lack of access to broadband. There's still large swaths of the country, especially if you go globally, that don't have the kind of broadband support that they need to download a 60-gig game like Halo 5.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. And, the reason people play games, like the number one reason is the genre. So, for example, it doesn't matter how good a racing game is, I'm probably not going to play it just because it's not a genre that I'm interested in. And then the second most important thing is price. Like those are the two big things that drive purchases. And then like user reviews, graphics, recommendations, all that is way, way lower. But graphics and price are still like king when it comes to people deciding what they're going to play. And then probably the most interesting part of the talk was why people stop playing. And so one was loss of interest, which I was like, okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Friction of spending money or game progression. So either you don't want to spend the money on World of Warcraft anymore to stay in the guild, or you feel like you've gotten stuck. And I know that that has killed several games for me where I've gotten stuck and I'm sad I'm done.
Yeah.
And then the game fails to meet expectations, which I thought was really interesting.
Like some panels.
Yeah. 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 I didn't want to talk about that too much. So that was one of the good ones. And I'm looking through my notes right now because there was one that was I feel like there are so many that were so good. Let's see, choice and not that one. I did a couple of VR panels, but I didn't find them particularly helpful, mostly because they're for people who are actually developing VR games.
I find that conversation really, really interesting because at first I used to think, well, you just put me inside the game, right? Like it shouldn't be that hard to just save as VR and then you're done, right? If it's a first-person shooter or something like that. But there are a lot of things that go into that I never thought about and are kind of mind-blowing to me anyway. So did you pick up anything that kind of surprised you in those?
I mean, it was stuff that when I thought about, it made sense. So the idea of foveal focus, the fovea being the center point in the back of your eye, and that's where you focus on things. And the eye only focuses on a very limited field at a time, whereas your peripheral vision is usually blurry and not in focus. So, you know, if you're trying to render a game, there's no point in making everything rendered at high def because the person is only looking at such a small part of the screen at any given time, which I thought was super interesting. Another one was periphery is how people get sick. So either block out periphery, you know, like the black bars on the side of an old school TV, like just black out the periphery. Or you have to stabilize it in some other way. And maybe the most interesting example is they were playing a racing game. And they talked about how you can't have acceleration. When you're having a VR camera, you can't accelerate. The camera should never accelerate. It should always be at the same speed. Otherwise, that's when you get people who are puking all over the place, mm-hmm. which was really interesting. And there was one of the games I actually played was a VR game. And it was it used eye tracking, so I didn't even have to touch a controller or anything, and it was a puzzle game. So I would look at this particular spot on a piece, and then I could move it. And the pieces looked like Stonehenge pieces with designs on them, and then you matched up the design to make the puzzle. I felt like this is what telekinetics would feel like. If I could move things with my mind, this is what it would be like.
Yeah, and that's working because we finally have the technology that can... They can see such minor movements of the eye. You know, it can track at such a small scale that even just looking at something and the movement of your eyes can be, there's enough information there to be able to translate it into something functional. Yeah, it's kind of cool.
So that was kind of my VR experience. The VR panels were very, very crowded, and those were the only times I ever had to queue. But
did you hear in any of those that they talk about, like some of the things that really surprised me are things like they have to consider the height of the camera?
Yes.
Because it can be very different, right? Because your height is something, and then like usually a first person shooter is like the camera's positioned a certain way, but your height, like what did they say about that?
They talked about it mostly as a like an old school film technique that if the camera is placed low and everything seems bigger than you, then you're going to experience a sense of disempowerment or feeling weak and vulnerable. Whereas if the camera is placed high and you're kind of looking down on maybe others or on your surroundings, then it gives you kind of that superhero sense of being powerful. Mm-hmm. So that was, I mean, more specifically about creating emotional narrative through VR without words.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it was super interesting in that respect. But most of it, I would say the vast majority of the stuff was technical things about that was a little bit over my head, but still glad I went.
So much of it, it does, like, there's such a, the psychology behind a lot of it is so interesting, because there are things like, wait a minute, I'm usually this high and you're usually that high, and now, like, it feels so different to be a different height in this world, or look down and not, like, in a first-person shooter, you look down and rarely do you see your feet, for example, right? But in a VR game, if you look down and you don't see your body, that can be very disorienting. So yes, kind of taking that kind of stuff into consideration that you don't have to worry about when it's a static camera on a traditional screen.
Or if you look down and you see your body, but it's obviously not your body. Mm-hmm. There was a one about immersion in VR, and how, for example, if you are a female and you look down and you've got hairy man legs, it's going to kind of break up some of the immersion. And if you're a dude and you look down and you've got, you know, sexy bikini model legs, it's going to be a weird experience that might break the immersion for you. But from what I saw with it, I played four different VR games. One of them was a space turret simulator. So I get into the cockpit of what looks like the Millennium Falcon. Mm-hmm. And I have to use the buttons on the side of the Samsung HD, I think is what it was. And I turn my head and my eyes focus, and that's how I target, and I push the button and I blow things up. And that was fun. It was something that I think would have been fun for like 10 minutes, and then I would have said, okay, what's next?
This was on the Samsung, on the Gear VR?
Yes, the Gear.
This is Samsung? Okay.
Yeah, on the Gear. And then I played the puzzle one, which was fun, but I'm like, okay, you know, this is nice. This is cool. It's very pretty. It's very aesthetic, but it's not quite actiony enough for me. Then I made the huge mistake of playing Goosebumps. Ooh. As in the young adult fiction horror.
R.L. Stine books.
Yeah. Yes. And as I loaded up, I realized this was a very bad idea, because as it's loading, the gnomes from one of the books like flash on the screen and then disappear.
Oh, no.
And I was like, this is going to be bad. This is going to be so bad, but I want to try everything. And so I'm moving through this VR world by looking at footprints on the floor, and then it moves me to that footprint. And I turn a corner, and there's this zombie thing, and a voice, disembodied voice, is like, oh, be careful, that's a walking zombie. As long as you stay away, you know, she can't get you because she moves slow. And so I'm looking down trying to find, how do I get around this zombie? But instead it took me to the next space that was right next to her. And then all of a sudden I have this scary zombie in my eyeballs eating my face, and it scared the daylights out of me, and I was done. I was just done. I tapped out of that sofa. I almost took the headset off. It was that uncomfortable. And then the last one I played was a lot of fun. It was, are you familiar with the mobile game The Room?
Yes.
So it's an escape room game, and you solve puzzles to find your way out. Well, that was on the VR. It was really cool, because I was in a swivel chair, so I'm like swiveling back and forth to navigate through this room and going
up. Looking for clues.
I turned off the light, and stuff was written in neon on the wall, and I ran out of time. They tapped me out before I could find my way, but I was pretty close to finishing, and that was really cool. That to me was, I wanted to go back and do more of that. That was right up my alley.
Did you try either the HTC Vive or the Oculus Rift or the PlayStation VR?
Well, you know, I wouldn't be caught dead touching PlayStation, so I skipped that one. The Vive, I didn't see it there. And Oculus, the line was just, it was too long. Even for a two-story behemoth, it was too much. So limited time, because there were so many panels I wanted to go to. The games were actually secondary, and for good reason, because another one of my favorite panels was called Character Motivation. And it was by Dr. Yi, I think was his name. And oh my gosh, I'm going to share the notes with you, because they are beautiful and they need to just be in a museum, because they're so fantastic. But he used fancy statistics like bootstrapping to do a factor analysis model of why people play. And it was split into achievement and socializing. So in the achievement sphere, there was leveling up, feeling powerful, and collecting loot. And in the socializing sphere, it was chatting, being with friends, and helping others, which was really, really cool. And again, I'll have to share the notes, because it was, he came up with 12 unique paired motivations, So there were six motivations, and they each had a pairing with them, which, again, it's really hard to describe. But when you look at the model, basically there was action, social, mastery, achievement, immersion, and creativity. And there's two different reasons that people played those. And then he broke that down into a motivation map, which clumped everything together. And again, I can't even do justice because the talk will be on the GDC vault, and I'll see if I can get it to you, because it was a half an hour. I felt like my hair was blown back. You know, that was like a mind-exploding panel. And he had this fantastic quote where he said, "Games are an identity management tool. They play games, players play games which align with their core personality traits, and games help us to become more like who we really are."
Ooh.
I was like, I have chills right now. I have chills.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And then the last piece that I really appreciated, because again, I had no idea about this one, is that usually they say that the big difference between genres, like what people like, is gender. You know, women prefer motivation, or they're fantasy-driven design and completion. Guys want to blow shit up, is pretty much what he said. But when you factored in age, the difference in gender disappeared. So like the older people get, the more like similar their genre tastes are. So basically the data is saying that it's the age, not the gender, that's the main concern in what kind of genres people like. And actually that there's a bigger difference between young men and old men than young men and young women in terms of their genre preferences.
Yeah.
So I think that's so cool, because there's so much focused on, men game and women games, games for men, games for boys, games for girls, when really the data is showing that it's about, games for teens and games for middle and older age. I think it starts to level off.
So
around
as girls 35. Get older and they become women, they become young boys. That's what you said, right?
In
terms of their gaming habits or interests.
Hold on. This one was specifically about the image I have right now is specifically about competition. Because the idea is, well, women don't like competitive games. That's why they like Skyrim and not Halo, is the general idea. But what they found is that women and men aged about 35 to 55, their preferences for competition is almost identical. Whereas it's a little bit further apart for, say, young men and young women. But the difference between young men and old men in their preference for competition is a greater difference than between young men and young women. So basically, a 18-year-old guy and a 40-year-old guy are more different in their preferences than an 18-year-old guy and an 18-year-old girl.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, it's really tough because the graph is fantastic, the words not so much.
And then as they get older, it skews towards less competition or more competition?
Less.
Okay.
Which I think is very... I find it obvious because I know that as people get older, they tend to get away from the Twitch shooters, which tend to be the more competitive games anyway. Yeah. And to be competitive...
Technically, it's just more difficult for you because your brain isn't as fast. Yeah.
Yeah, and you probably have less time to dedicate to being good at a competitive game. I just found that really fascinating that it's not so much gender gender, there is a difference, but it really is age, specifically in the realm of competition of what people like. So if you wanted to make a game for, say, 50-somethings, you would do very well to stay away from competition.
Gotcha.
So pro tip out there for anybody designing for older audiences. And let's hear another one. Okay, so there was another one. This was an interesting one because it was presented by the project designer person from Ubisoft, who is not a psychologist nor a researcher, but he talked about the Big Five personality theory and self-determination theory as a way to figure out why people play and why they keep playing. And it was this weird tension for me because what he's saying is interesting, and I hadn't thought about things in that way in particular. So, for example, that the Big Five correlate to game interests, if that makes sense. So, for example, people who tend to be high on extroversion tend to prefer high action games, and they also tend to like very social games, whereas somebody who's higher in conscientiousness is going to like puzzle games more. So that was pretty cool. But ultimately, he went to basically, he said the big five personality is what gets you into a game, and that satisfaction theory is what keeps you in the game. So kind of like Nikki said, that people play games that are in line with their personality traits. So they gravitate toward games that make them feel more like who they are. And then what this Ubisoft guy added on is that the reason they keep playing and why they become really dug in deep with a game is because it satisfies their competence, autonomy, and relatedness needs, which are the three core needs of self-determination theory.
Gotcha.
Which, again, with pictures, makes a lot more sense than I'm realizing as I'm talking about it. But yeah, I'll see if I can post my notes and if anybody can decipher them.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. I mean, like at the big five thing, yeah, fine. You know, that like the correlation sounds spot on, right? Like it makes sense. I think that would make sense to anybody. And then, but the idea of like being like playing to fulfill that experience of being who you are. Mm-hmm. And then how the game helps you get there, right, through the self-determination theory, to be able to actually feel more like you, right? I guess that's an easier way to put it. That as you progress, you'll feel more like you.
Yeah, right? That you're getting your needs met. So, you know, I pick up a game that is in line with what I enjoy at a surface level. But then the reason I keep playing is because it's satisfying my human needs, my basic needs. Was what he was saying. And it's a very interesting idea. The only thing that really kind of irked me was he said, and I quote, "Self-determination theory is the most important psychological theory."
Yes.
And I was like, okay. Oh, no. Oh, no, honey, well, no.
So he should have continued to say the most important psychological theory to implement in your game to make money or something like that, like not just like the blanket statement as related to human behavior.
Yeah, if he had followed it up with it's the most important psychological theory for game design,
maximizing
or for player
profits.
Yeah, player engagement, I could have swallowed that, but he's like, you need to learn SDT because it's the most important psychological theory out there. And I just shook my head. I was like, no, 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 that's no. Sigh. And then here's the last one. Again, I went to a lot of really cool stuff. I did a lot of really cool things, but I'm going to try and keep it succinct. The last one I went to was this fascinating panel about gender in games throughout the centuries. So the speaker started with chess and how originally chess were just kind of amorphous blobs that looked different. Because having where chess started from in the Middle East, having something that looked like a human or an animal was considered idol worship. So all the pieces were like, it's a box. It's a box with a hook. It's a box with a triangle. And then how that, it used to be like a very slow-paced game over days and days, and was considered a flirting game. Actually, chess was considered like a flirting game because of how slow it moved and how long it took. So women were encouraged for hundreds of years to play chess in public because it showed off how smart they were, and it was a way to court and all this crazy, crazy stuff. And then the rules of chess changed. So to be queen's chess, which is much more aggressive, you know, where now all the pieces are powerful as opposed to being really disempowered. And so women were told to stop playing chess because it was seen as aggressive and a man's thing. Which I had never known any of that. And then she kind of progressed through the centuries and got to, you know, like the 70s when I think the stat was only 3% of ads for games were gender specific, like gender targeted for traditional gender roles, like a girl in the kitchen and a boy with a toolbox. Only 3%, which is insane. That blew my mind. And what happened, apparently it was in the 80s, in 1984, there was deregulation in the television industry that allowed cartoon companies to make games or to make cartoons about toys. So I don't know if you knew this, Hosway, but He-Man.
Some of my favorite cartoons, yeah, they were made to sell me toys.
I didn't know that He-Man was an action figure and then a cartoon. And I didn't know that My Little Ponies was first an action figure and then a cartoon. But yeah, they were specifically made to sell the toys because of this deregulation. And then you see this giant differentiation between boys' toys and video and TV and girls' toys and TV because they're trying to sell the story associated with the action figure or the toy. And then there's, you just see everything kind of come crashing down. Everything girl goes pink. Everything boy goes blue. All the computer games go to boys. All the technology is targeted to boys. And girls are focused more on mall madness and fashion, everything. And I mean, she even showed this really cool board layout of Candyland. And the very first edition of Candyland, there were characters, but they were just kind of weird looking characters. And maybe you could assign gender to them, maybe not. And then 10 years later, she showed the Candyland game that we know pretty well, where, you know, very Queen Frost. Yeah, it's very pink. And there's, you know, Queen Frostine, who is obviously Queen Frostine, and you, these different genders. Or the other one that was really interesting, it was called Bargain Sale, I think. And she showed a clip from 1970, and it was a family. It was a mom and a dad, a son and a daughter, and they were all doing the shopping game where they found, like, the best bargain. And that's really cool. You know, everybody's together. It's family game night. It's gender neutral because everybody's enjoying it. You know, it's shopping, but it's for everybody. And then 8 years later, it was re-released as, what was it called? Mall Madness, which was all pink. Mm. It was only for girls. It took place in a shopping mall. And I remember this game from when I was little. I had a speaker that told you, hey, there's a discount at the mall, or there's a discount at the shoe store. And so it's this... The mechanics are the same. It's the same game. It's the same company. It's the same designers. But because of this shift in deregulation of television and the marketing, it suddenly became you had to target gender-specific audiences. And it just – I was like, wow. Oh, my gosh. My mind's like blown. I knew this was a thing, but I didn't know it was this much of a thing. And it felt really good to know that there was a reason why this was a thing. And – yeah, so that was actually the last panel that I went to. So I started and I ended high, so I'm feeling good.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean that talk there's a lot of parallels to the conversations we've been having lately about targeting and about even since we have the technology now, so that those games can be pretty much made on those modifications can be made on the fly, mm-hmm. right? So if you do like blue more, your game will be more blue. And if you like pink more, your game will be more pink, because that kind of targeting, that's why like some of that stuff, like it worries me, right? That we make that easier and easier because look at the effects that it had, that it's had over time. Whew, man.
Yeah, it seems to be this weird pendulum effect of women allowed to do things and then told not to do it. Another thing she pointed out was hopscotch was originally a game for boys because it was seen as too physically demanding for girls. Mm-hmm. And now most people think, I'm sorry, jump rope, not hopscotch. Jump rope was seen as a boys only activity. But now it's in the domain of women. Or chess, you know, women were encouraged to play and then they were told not to play. And then, you know, when video games first came out, women were told to play and they were encouraged to play. And then after 1984, oh, no, never mind. This is not for you. And it's just really interesting how that's all panned out. And I think what I like so much about it is that there's a reason, because the number one way to piss me off is when people on Twitter tell me, well, that's just the way it is. And that's the way it's always been. I can go, oh, no. Oh, no, it was not. It has not always been this way. And there's a reason it was made this way. And so it can change again.
That's been a theme here at my house for the last couple of days. But the role of historians, I think that historians are perhaps the most important people we have right now, because it is so important to have that background, to have that information, so we can see what's going on now and have a real productive conversation. Because starting from, well, I don't know why we're here, but let's talk about where we're going or how to change things is not the best way to do things.
No, that's a perfect example. I know with the election going on right now, there's a lot of people freaking out, and whether or not that's a good or a bad thing, you know, I expressed to my husband, who lives, breathes, bleeds politics, and you know, I was like, man, has it ever been this divisive before? It feels just so polarized. And he looks at me and goes, Kelly, we fought a civil war. It's not that bad. Oh, that's right. There was that little thing where we were so divided, we tore the country apart. Yeah. So, yeah, but absolutely, that retrospective is so, so important. And I think that really empowered that speech as well, because, again, there's nothing worse than being told, well, that's just the way it is. No.
Random fact, there is a novel called, I believe it's Empire by Orson Scott Card, and I believe it's like in the future where we do have a civil war based along ideological lines again, but it's like Republicans and Democrats. And I don't know if your husband has read that or if you have.
I haven't.
No? Okay. I'm just saying, there's sci-fi out there. So those were the talks. It sounds like your expectations were high and they were definitely not met.
That's a good way to put it. Myself and the two other people in my cohort who went, we all kind of universally agreed that it was a positive experience. But one, it definitely didn't live up to the hype. And two, there's no way we would pay the $2,000 for a ticket plus airfare plus hotel to do it again. And I mean, the reason that we went this time is one, we were speakers, so we didn't have to pay for a badge. And two, our university paid for the hotel and the flights. So I know for me, it felt kind of almost like a relief that, okay, I'm not missing out on this amazing thing. I mean, it was great. I don't want to say that it wasn't, but I don't think it doesn't live up to the hype, at least for someone coming from the academic side of things. Now for developers, it might be different. I heard somebody describe it as GDC is entering the lottery for someone to change your life. If you're a developer, you know, you go in and you show your game and you're surrounded by all these people who, you know, could make things happen, but it's kind of, again, like drawing a lottery ticket to see if your life will change. But from the academic side, it was like, okay, cool. Although one thing that GDC does very well is they tape all of the sessions and they put them in the GDC vault. So that way you can always go back and watch them again.
Yeah, I always consider GDC, like many professional industry conferences, it's an opportunity for people to learn from each other. And I know that very specific focused conferences like the Worldwide Developers Conference by Apple, Google has a very similar one. And those are opportunities for people to come in and learn the new technology, the new things that are coming from the people who created them. So it kind of really, it's almost a necessity because you're setting up it's like mandatory professional development so that you can stay competitive with the industry. And this isn't as specific, right? I mean, it's gaming focused, but there's all sorts of technology there and there's a lot of things going on. But I know that this year VR was a huge thing. So I can only imagine that a lot of people who are getting into VR now were able to learn a lot from each other. The news coverage was very VR focused, but was the listing of panels and presentations as VR focused as I think it might have been?
Well, there was an entire VR track. So, for example, at GDC, you can, instead of buying an all access pass, you can get track specific. So there's a community specific track and a VR specific track. And so everything that was in the VR specific track was jam packed and there was a ton of it. One of the cohort who went with me, she did a lot of the VR panels and she probably did five or six of them. And she basically reported back saying they're all saying the same thing, that there are no best practices, but this is what we've learned so far. And those learnings seem to be consistent.
Gotcha. So having gone to GDC the year that VR is happening, right? This is 30 years in the making, but this is the year where finally we have consumer products at different levels. Like you tried the Gear VR, which technically if you have an Android phone only has a $100 price of entry. If you have any other phone, you could do something like the new ViewMaster or even the Google Cardboard, which are as cheap as $10 to $30, all the way up to the HTC Vive, which is $800 plus the cost of a $800 or $900 computer. I mean, but they're all here, right? They will be by the end of the year. So, like, what was your takeaway being there among that now? Like, what were people saying? How did it feel?
Well, the first thing when I saw John when I got back was, we're going to need to get some kind of VR device when they're publicly available, because what I got to experience was really cool. And I really enjoyed the games that I played on VR. And I think some of them are going to be gimmicky, but I think as developers get used to them more, at the Experimental Game Workshop, I saw some really cool VR things that are coming down the pipeline. And so I know I definitely want one in the future. And especially with the price points being what they are, I'm not quite sure where HoloLens works into this quite yet, because I do want an Xbox version, but we'll see.
So the HoloLens, there is a developer's kit that you can buy. It only costs $3,000.
Oh, yeah. Do that all. I'll buy two.
Just so you know. Okay.
But I mean, as far as I could tell, I mean, people were excited for it. Again, they were the busiest panels. Yeah. They were the only ones I saw that had queues, where people had to line up. If you were in the VR track, you had your own line to guarantee that you got in. And if you did not have a VR track pass like I did, then you had to wait in a separate line to see if there would be room for you. And again, I only went to one or two of them. And the couple that I went to were very kind of biologically focused. And someone did say that there was a quote. I think he said, psychology is the language of virtual reality. Which I thought, okay, that makes sense. I mean, because everything they're talking about is it's neuroanatomy and it's neuropsychology, so I'm not quite sure psychology is the language, is the exact term you wanted, but the idea that the reason that games work in VR or do not work in VR is based entirely, mostly on the way that the human mind works, the way that our eyes track, the way that we understand and perceive information and data, more than it's ever been before. But yeah, people were stoked. There was a giant VR lounge, but you could only get in by appointment. So it was definitely the hoity-toity thing to do at GDC.
And I sometimes don't know how serious your Sony hate is. as much as I'm, that's my preference, I'm pretty agnostic. I think that, having tried so many different versions, I think it's still really expensive, and not a lot of people are going to be able to own VR maybe in 2016, but definitely people will see it and finally experience it, because it's so hard to talk about, right, unless you've experienced it. And I'm really excited about the PlayStation version, because it will be, it's still $400, but it's only $400 plus the PlayStation, which is more affordable than the computer versions, regardless of whether or not the quality is as high. But in the prediction show I did a couple months ago, I said that one of the things I was hoping for was for VR to really open the door to different experiences. And then Sony announced this, it's called a cinematic mode, which is essentially you can have a virtual living room and have a television up to 225 inches. So it's not just about, it's going to open up so many different things, where right now the VR headset can replace your TV, because you don't even need the TV anymore. You can project a fake TV. You can have a fake TV of different sizes inside this virtual space. And that is just one of the small things that you could do with this potentially. I think it's going to change a lot of things, and gaming is driving that, because they're the ones that are going to wow us the most. Mm-hmm. But it is, it's so exciting. The reason why I'm mostly jealous is, I would have skipped a lot of the panels and just waited in line for a long time to try out, especially something like Vive, which the reason it's so expensive is because, in addition to, you mentioned eye tracking, but Vive, it's that expensive because it comes with an entire setup with cameras for your room, and you need a 10 by 10 space to walk around in, because it is not only tracking your head movement, it is tracking your body movements and where you're located in the room. And so it's opening a door for a lot of things, and immersion is the key. And I don't know, I would have loved to have been there and tried all that stuff.
Yeah, again, I'm not sure the Vive was there. I don't remember seeing it. But I did remember seeing this one thing that looked like something off of Star Trek or some kind of future sci-fi, where they had a virtual reality headset. I think it was an Oculus, but it also came with these two. They looked like D-rings, but you would hold them in your hand. So almost like brass knuckles.
Yeah, those are the Oculus Touch controllers.
So they had those, so that way when you move your arms in physical space, you see your arms move in the virtual space. But they also had this, the only thing it reminded me of is, you know how you can put babies in jumpers? Like you put them in that little plastic thing and they can like bounce up and down and move in circles, but they're propped up in this one little,
yeah,
right? It's called a bouncer, I think, or a jumper. I'm not quite sure, but that's basically what it looked like. It was this.
I know what you mean.
So yeah, people would climb into this. It was like a harness, like a baby bouncer, and so they could spin in circles while they were holding on to the Oculus grips, and they had the Oculus on, and it looked really cool. I mean, it looked like, because that's definitely the biggest disconnect I felt when I was playing VR, is that I'm sitting, and so when I'm playing the puzzle game and like soaring over these beautiful vistas, I'm still sitting, and so the immersion isn't quite, I think, as deep as it could be if my physical body was imitating what my virtual body was doing. And that's what they talked about a lot in the panels too, is that the more your physical body can emulate what your virtual body is doing, the more immersed you're going to be. So if your character is standing in the game, the player should be standing. If your character is sitting in the game, then your character should be sitting. And that's going to improve the overall experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that particular, I think there's going to be, that's one specific type of experience. But I think, like, I'm looking forward to just playing how we're playing now, but being able to sit down and kind of control the camera with my head and kind of still play with the controller, still be comfortable on my couch, but also having just a little bit more of that immersive feeling.
Yeah.
That's like, that's as far as I want to get in 2016.
Oh yeah, I mean this is obviously further down the line stuff, but it is very exciting, and I do feel like we've moved past the gimmicky thing. I think horror games on VR are something I will never touch because it was awful. I don't see how anybody could stand that, but I could not. But I am looking forward to puzzle games.
Well, a lot of people love the horror experience, and this is just making it more. Right? Oh, making it
there's something really disturbing about in a hallway. This was the Goosebumps game, and I'm afraid to turn around because I'm afraid something's going to jump out at me. You know, it's one thing when I'm playing on my console, I've got some distance from the TV. You know, I've got some distance, and I can ground myself in the fact that I can see my living room, and I can see my couch, and I can see my dog. But I was at the Goosebumps.
You can have the lights on.
I can have the lights on, and I'm Goosebumps. And of course, I have the headphones on. And so my auditory and visual processing is completely consumed. And I just remember standing there thinking, I kind of started to look behind me. I was like, no, something's going to jump out at you. And then something jumped out at me in the face. And so, yeah, if you like that kind of thing, you're really going to enjoy those kinds of games. But I don't think that's going to be me. Definitely not. That's all I got.
Well, thank you for your GDC report. Actually, the last question I have is, how did your panel go?
Oh, thank you for asking. My panel, it went great. There were four of us, so my professor Lindsay Grice, myself, and my two cohort, Joyce Rice and Therese Datu. And again, we talked about community engagement because games are really good at engaging communities, and news journalism in general is not. They are not very good at getting people to care about what they're doing. And so we looked at things such as like what motivates troll behavior, because that's an engagement killer. We looked at what news has done well. We looked at what it's done poorly. We looked at the kind of tools that game designers have in community management. So, you know, rather than just killing the comments, like a lot of prolific blogs have done, like TC Coates had a really amazing comment section that he had to shut down. Scientific American effectively banned everybody because they shut down their comment section completely. And so I showed off some of Griffball Hub's backend tools that, you know, you can time someone out for 30 minutes or you can IP ban them forever. And just being able to have the appropriate tools so that the punishment can match the crime, so to speak. And then also talked a little bit about how community managers spend a lot of time dealing with the bad apples, but it's also important to give feedback to the good apples as well. And that I think a lot of times the positive parts of community get forgotten because your resources are so tied up in the not so good people. But
How was the reaction from like the people you spoke to? What was that like?
I had three people come up to me throughout the convention, like days later, to say that they really enjoyed the panel and it was great. But that's really all the feedback I've gotten so far. But GDC has this really cool feedback system where the card on your ID, they scan it before you go into a panel. And then at the end of the panel, you get emailed a survey. And the survey has you rank or rate the presentation and the speakers. Okay. So in a couple of weeks, I'm sure we'll get our feedback back and we'll know how we did and what people thought. So I'm excited about that.
Awesome. Yeah, because I hear that if you mess up your first presentation, you'll never get to go back.
Yeah, there's a lot that rides on the line, and it sounds funny, but, you know, because first of all, this irritated the crap out of me, and I'm sure all my statisticians and survey builders out there will agree, there were only four options. It was, like, how did you like the panel? Like, it was the most amazing thing ever. Definitely invite back. Average. Below average, severely below average, definitely do not invite back. And so that irritates me because 2, 3, 5, or 7, I mean, come on, that's basic survey stuff because you, I know you don't want average because it doesn't give you anything, but now you've just made above average average, so it's kind of stupid. Yeah. But yeah, if you get good ratings, it can be really beneficial to you getting in again. So it's kind of like a litmus test at the beginning to see if people liked you or not. So it's a little nerve wracking, a little tense, but I'm looking forward to it. I think we did really well.
Awesome.
And it will also be on the vault when available.
Yeah. I can judge it for myself.
Yes, you can. And of course, if people listening want to get a taste themselves, keep in mind that Josue and I will be at PAX East next month, April 21st through the 23rd, I believe. You know, 22nd through the 24th. Yeah. 22nd through the 24th. We have a panel, a psych tech panel, basically reviewing the year 2015 with psychology and technology. So how games and psych how they fared last year. The good, the bad, the APA, all that good stuff going on.
And now we can add the GDC to it.
So we'll be reviewing that and you can check us out. That's 2 p.m. in the Arachnid Theater. Again, that's PAX East of Boston on April 22nd. And since you've already got your Friday batch, you come to the 11 o'clock one, which is based on some of my research, which is about game design and how it reflects societal values of mental health. So I'm very, very excited about that one. I'm excited about both of them. It's going to be a great time. So you should come. Do it. PAX. Do it. All right, Ella, that's us. That's us. Goodness. That's it for this episode of Psych Tech. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Psych Tech Cast, and you can find us on our homepage, psychtechpodcast.com. We have RSS, we're on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, everything under the sun. So find, follow, subscribe, and let us know what you think about the show and tweet at us and look forward to hearing your feedback. So until next week, see you later, Josue.
See you.